Kids are not defective. Part 4. The mutually destructive exchange. The root causes of bullying.
Hello, everyone. Today's show will have a little bit more of a solemn tone, I think, than you might be used to. I don't want to distract from the seriousness of this topic. I just want to talk about it in a very sort of straightforward and clear and concise way. One of my concerns about this show, as I've gone back and listened to older episodes, is sometimes I think I might strive for a little bit too much amusement when talking about things that are tragic and even traumatic. And sure, you know, usually I do like to keep things light and entertaining and hopefully find a way to get a serious message across through that kind of presentation. I've found just by watching people like Carlin, you can take your message a lot further when it's kind of wrapped up in comedy. Like even the title of the show, School Sucks, is not something that the typical people who are involved in snipping the branches on the tree of evil of government education would look at very seriously. I also find that trying to be a little bit lighter can loosen up the tension that a lot of us might feel related to some of these topics, especially the stuff we're talking about now. But for today, I just want to make sure that I'm giving this a completely respectful treatment. And this is a topic that I take very, very seriously. I've seen a lot of it in my own experience, both as a young person and as an educator. So like I said, clear, concise, right to the point, no distractions. Middle school and high school, those environments on their own, I think, are enough to create the kind of horrendous negative social interactions that we see. But in most cases, I don't think that's where the genesis really is. From my own experience, I would say that most people bully others to avoid looking at themselves. It's a kind of misdirection away from their own low self-esteem. Some of the most common bullies in school today are the athletes. And I think this makes sense if you look at how seriously parents take sports. This is something else that we'll talk about in the future in this series as well. When a human being is reduced to a machine that makes their father feel good by scoring baskets, that in itself can be somewhat traumatic, I think, even though it is covered up by a lot of other distractions and noise. But we see why those kinds of students become bullies for the very reason that I spoke about, kind of a misdirection away from their own low self-esteem, their own sense of feeling valueless as they kind of find themselves in this relationship with their parents, which is pretty much conditional and seems to be entirely dependent on their athletic ability. That would suck. But public school and middle school, now, like I remember saying in a show a while back that I went into a school for the first time in like a year and a half, I've actually been spending a little bit more time in these schools because I started working with some people in new places, and it was helpful for them if I could meet them in the school at the end of the school day. So I've logged quite a few more hours observing that environment. And the environment is interesting, and it's actually quite upsetting. If you go into a school and you kind of know what you're looking for, you don't see rational beings making choices. You see the Discovery Channel, pretty much. And I'm not trying to be cute. That's really a way that I think is fitting to describe this. We've all seen the show on the Discovery Channel where, you know, it's like crocodiles versus the wildebeest, where the wildebeest have to cross some body of water that's just filled with crocodiles, and they're going to get eaten, like, you know, every time they try to cross. But there's something about their, you know, animal instinct that makes them need to cross the river at that time. If we try to look at the behavior of wildebeests and apply some regard for rational self-interest to what they're doing, we would just say, wow, that's really stupid. Why do they do that? But they're just driven to do that. They're driven by unconscious forces, by nature. Now, I am not of the opinion that man has any definite nature.
Well, that might sound like a strange thing to say, because we've heard that phrase over and over again throughout our entire lives, human nature, human nature, human nature. But I just think that, you know, individual human beings, if you look at their creative capacity, if you look at their imagination, if you look at individuality, it would be hard to pigeonhole the entire species into a definite nature. Like if you today made a bunch of observations about crocodiles and then, you know, you hypothetically traveled back in time 5,000 years, you'd find that crocodiles are pretty much doing the same thing, even right down to an individual level. Human beings are not doing the same thing on an individual level. On a collective level, sure, whenever you have some kind of collective or group organized around a mythology, a state, or a religion, they do have a little bit more of a nature. They're far more predictable. Maybe that helps explain why I'm using this Discovery Channel example to describe what I see in these buildings, because you're not really always just looking at individuals. You're kind of looking at people who are caught up and forced into that mob mentality. You know, another reason why we should stay away from this whole human nature concept is look at how dramatically one individual can change within the course of even their adult life, the kind of intellectual or emotional transformation that can happen. So I think that's one reason why we should stay away from this concept of human nature. But one thing that I have observed firsthand is that people can certainly become victims of compulsion, of self-medication and codependence, which are, I guess we could call those unconscious forces, as long as we choose to keep them unconscious. Like, the wildebeest doesn't have a choice. We do. But in these school environments, if you observe them, you will see a lot of people trying to manage the same kind of trauma and even act out aggression. They just have different ways of doing it. And most of it appears to be unconscious. If you happen to catch one of these interactions in progress, this used to happen to me all the time years ago when I was in a different educational environment. And you went up to the kid who was just viciously bullying some other kid and you said, "Why are you doing this?" He couldn't even give you a bad answer. There's no answer to that. In school, the bullies seek victims, obviously. But the standard victims also seek bullies. There's something in it for them as well. Now, you might be thinking, wow, that's a really heartless kind of blame the victim thing to say. And if you only care about dealing with the symptom of a problem, then yeah, I guess it is. Like, if your only concern is like, how do we stop this bullying from actually physically taking place? That wouldn't be the right approach. So it's the wrong approach for the wrong approach. Now, of course, when it comes to the school or even the state itself, those organizations can only look at symptoms. Anything else would be just too much of a liability. Because if they addressed root causes of negative or disrespectful behavior effectively, it would just be a matter of time before all of their own institutions collapsed. So instead, they do what they always do. Crackdown. A crackdown that just targets the symptom. But we have to go back further. We have to look closer. In other words, like if we had a production line, and the problem is that the product that comes off at the end is some horrible, dangerous thing, the question that we ask is not, well, how do we stop that last step in the production process where the thing comes off the line and goes into the box? We stop the whole process. That's what you really have to do here. And, you know, I know that if you've listened to this show for a while, hearing me use a metaphor like a processing plant and products for children in education might be like pretty alarming and maybe even a little bit disturbing. But I'm using their thoughts and their language, the language of not children, but the central planners, the managers of societies. Of course, I don't think humans are products that roll off a production line, nor would I claim that I would be able to create a better production line or processing plant. Those are things we need to get rid of because that's not how you treat people. But just, I hope this metaphor is acceptable for this situation. But if it is our goal to stop the kind of confusion and root problems and mythologies that make an environment like that possible, then yeah, we need to point out the fact that a lot of the times, the victims want to be bullies too, and they will use their position as the victim to be the bully. And I'll explain what I mean. Even though these stories appear to end in very different looking places, they begin in pretty much the same place. The mistreatment of children by adults. The bigger, stronger, more athletic kids are the most obvious, easy to spot bullies. They can use their physical stature to intimidate, coerce, steal, embarrass smaller, weaker kids. But their targets, the victims, they have their own strategies for bullying. One being this kind of moral superiority. They want to make the bully pay a spiritual price, so to speak. If you've spent any time in these environments, you've probably noticed a scene like the bully chasing after his victim, trying to hold back a kind of nervous laughter and saying, "Come back, come back, I'm sorry." Here we see a place where the victim has won in his attempt to bully the bully. Now, of course, really, this is not a win-lose situation. This is, you know, lose-lose. Bullying is one of the most hideous forms of acting out this repressed childhood trauma because the aggressor is not even pretending that his or her actions or intentions are virtuous. And even when we consider all of the horrible stuff that goes on this planet, this is actually quite rare to not attempt to ascribe some kind of virtuous motive to your actions. I think this is part of the reason why bullies usually like to work in groups, where they can at least get some comfort in the fact that others are also participating in this vile treatment of others. No one wants to, like, admit that they're bad. When I say humans have no nature, I will point out that it is very, very rare for a person to look at themselves in any kind of honest way and say, "Wow, I am pure evil." And I mentioned all of this horrible stuff that goes on in the world. Remember the public school ethics lesson? Hitler versus Mother Teresa? Well, Hitler actually believed that or told himself the same story enough times. And there's others as well. Remember Mao's seizure of all of this control and property from people in China? It was a great leap. These kinds of evil people only surround themselves with other people who will call them like visionaries or saviors. And then we can see how, of course, this just goes everywhere. Everyone is running in all directions away from the truth. Politicians are always telling themselves stories about the common good. Unionized teachers are always telling themselves stories about what's best for the children. Cops hang around with cops. Jocks hang around with jocks. Heroin addicts hang around with other people who shoot heroin. Even both sides of the, in politics, even both sides of the hypocritical spectrum, they seek information that reinforces what they feel comfortable with. Nobody wants to admit anything. And, like, certainly not that what they're doing or what they're involved in or even what they're tolerating is actually pure evil. That's a realization that is devastating for just about anybody. So in this whole interaction, victim versus bully, bully versus victim, the victim will try to reveal the bully as evil. Their sort of secret weapon, this subtle moral condemnation. When this weapon is deployed successfully, we'll see the bullies say things like, "Oh, you know, I'm just kidding," or "We're just trying to loosen you up," or even just a kind of casual announcement, "I like you." That's so common to see the bully just kind of like not let the victim get away, the ostensible bully, to the usual victim. They don't want to let them get away. Bullies love their victims. Not real love for the person, but for the person's availability. Because where else could the bully's trauma and self-hatred go? So while the ostensible aggressor, the jock, the athlete, is actually like using physical intimidation, we see that the victim, they want that chance. They want that chance to strike back in a totally different way. The victim will even fantasize. I know this from experience. I was bullied at one point in my life. Of course, all of these athletes, that's who I was in high school. Those were my friends. We really, really sucked. But before that, when I was younger, when I was this awkward, pudgy kid in middle school, I was the victim. So I will tell you for sure, the victim will even fantasize about new ways and new cutting words and harsh phrases that can be employed to shame the bully. After the interaction, the victim will even replay what happened, except this time they will insert those fantasies into the interaction. And meanwhile, the bully will begin fantasizing about hilariously cruel new techniques for tomorrow. Both become addicted to this ritual of acting out this childhood trauma. And I just want to be extra super clear here to make sure that what I'm saying doesn't get misconstrued as, you know, if you see somebody being bullied or abused or mistreated by one of their peers, that the response should be something like, "Oh, well, that's what he wants." Because that's like the last step in a very, very long corrupt production line. There's more steps to go as we become adults and we become involved in politics. And but in school, this is like that's not an isolated incident, right? Both of those people are hurting. I really believe that both are really trying to squeeze something positive, something that somehow, somewhere feels good out of this mutually destructive exchange. I think what the aggressor wants is some kind of positive emotion from another person. And the person being bullied wants the exact same thing. For the aggressor, it's this recognition of dominance, right? Because we're probably talking about somebody who was either physically or mentally abused by their own parents, or somebody who, at the very least, has been through sports or activities or the micromanagement of their life, has been reduced by their parents into this object of conditional affection. And there's a lot of pain in all of that stuff. So they just want this feeling of control, right? What they have so little of in the rest of their life, where a schedule is made for them and love seems to be dependent on sports performance or whatever, the school play, the trumpet, activity after activity after activity, constantly just working like a slave for parental satisfaction all week long. Saturdays off, Sundays, church. What that person wants is control. They want somebody else to recognize that they are in control. the other person probably doesn't feel like they're worthy of any of that. And the positive emotion that they want from other people is concern that will come in the form of pity. So even though I really would describe this as unconscious, the real drive is for some kind of positive emotion to be returned to you or given to you from somebody else. The whole ritual is just going to continue to erode the already minimal self-esteem that both people have. The title of this series of shows is Kids Are Not Defective. I hope I'm not sending a message today that suggests that I really believe the opposite. Like the state itself on planet Earth, the condition of low self-esteem in your mind, not a natural condition. And like the state itself, much of our personal turmoil has grown to its current magnitude because of fantasies unchecked by reason and because of aggression unchecked by any kind of moral consistency. Both are current problems that we are trying to deal with. I honestly believe that as we start to take care of one, it will help with taking care of the other, and vice versa. But you have to see the whole picture. You have to see it from beginning to end. You have to see the whole process. And even though these stories appear to end in very different looking places, they begin in pretty much the same place. The mistreatment of children by adults. These adults can be parents, they can be family members. A lot of it is obviously teachers. A lot of this is obviously the school environment that forces all of this angst and negativity together into one location and forces the afflicted to interact with each other. And the people in charge of this institution are just mystified by this bullying problem. Because what we see is human beings, young adults, who are reduced to this condition where they just migrate to those interactions. They need them. I've seen so many times kids who are just treated like shit by other people. And then for whatever reason, they weren't there anymore. They moved, they went away, the environment changed, and the victim was gone. And the bullies would say, "Oh, I miss that guy. I liked him." They don't miss that guy. Like I said before, they miss that guy's availability. But as I learned in the most unfortunate way possible, sometimes the victims do disappear.
This was probably 5 or 6 months ago at least, and I was given a new student, somebody that I do business with once in a while, throws me some clients if he's overloaded for tutoring. And I went to this new family, I went to consult with them, and it was a, you know, boy, he was early in high school, and we talked for an hour. He was interested in music, so he showed me his drums, he showed me his guitar, I talked to his mother a little bit, and I left with a plan to start working with him next week. And it was like 3 or 4 days later, he killed himself. Supposedly, from what I gathered from another parent who also had a child at the same school, it was primarily the result of the constant bullying that he was subjected to at the school. Supposedly one student even told him that he should just kill himself. It made me ask, first of all, you know, what I'm guessing is a pretty standard question when a person so young takes their own life. How could somebody with their entire life ahead of them, whose problems, whose real problems, even though they probably felt like the weight of the world, were things that were temporary, that were going to pass, how could that happen? But on the other hand, it also made me ask, how could some other kid or some other group of kids be turned into such monsters that they would treat somebody like that or say something like that to somebody? You should just kill yourself.
Well, I hope that today we've at least begun to provide an acceptable and reasonable answer to both of those questions.
I followed up with people I talked to at the school, not people at the school, but parents of students at the school. That was just ultimately swept under the carpet, 'cause all they can do is crack down. All they do is crack down, right? There's no reflection. There's no, how did this happen? How did this environment lead to something like this even being possible? It would just be crackdown. But in this case, the school did nothing. And I just couldn't gather that much information about what happened, and I didn't really feel like talking about it, even though I didn't know this person. Just having that brief experience was, when I heard this news, it was just very distressing, and I didn't know what to say about it on the show. I wasn't really sure if there was a place for it on the show at the time. The other thing too, right when it happened, and I was thinking about it, and it maybe exploring some way to address it, there was something that didn't feel right about taking, you know, a recent tragedy for a person, for a family, and using it to make my point. I didn't need that story. You know what I mean? So I skipped it, but it just, something about the tone of the show today makes it hopefully fit right where it did. I obviously have kind of replayed the conversation that I had with this student for an hour. I've asked myself the sort of, maybe stupid and perhaps even self-aggrandizing question, is there something I could have said to make some kind of positive difference, to put all of that torture in perspective? That there's, you know, this stuff that's happening right now, there's a way to deal, there's a way to heal. What could I have said? Even if I knew, I mean, it's a torturous exercise to think, if I had known, could I have said something? Could I have said something like, the average human life is 20 times the length of high school. This is not it. Most of my career, I've worked with high school kids. And even when my primary concern was just teaching history, I always felt like by the time the kids got to me, it was too late. I was getting them at the end of it all, you know, 16, 17 years old. And to just use that kind of crummy and harsh analogy one more time, I felt like I was just the guy standing at the end of the production line holding the box. Like there was nothing I could do. Even though, you know, here I am years later, hoping I can prove myself wrong. But with respect to this kid that I almost got to work with, clearly it's a ridiculous fantasy of mine to think that there could be anything that I could have done or said in the span of an hour that would have changed the course that this kid was on. But gosh, I mean, you know, like, there are people today in the information age, on the internet, there are people lining up to help others in that kind of situation for free, with information and support and strategies. It's free. It's everywhere. How could somebody become so isolated where they would hang themselves? It seems to be
you know, aside from the Columbine style ending, these teen suicides that are supposedly driven by bullying seem to have that kind of dramatic ending. Hanging yourself is not a totally easy thing to do, and it's not exactly a pleasant way to go. It's kind of like a statement, though. It's not an AK-47 in the cafeteria, but it is that kind of final condemnation of the bully, where somebody who's in a total lose-lose situation has just found the most sad and desperate way to declare themselves the winner. Man, it doesn't need to be that way. In the next show, we'll loosen things up a little bit, hopefully, but this, I hope, has started to reveal one of the root causes behind this problem of bullying. Acting out these traumas, these feelings of powerlessness, dependence, anger from past experiences in childhood, with family, even from school. Remember, every bully is somebody else's victim. But it is not the only thing that I think we really need to be concerned about. Because in addition to all the stuff we talked about today, one of the reasons why this is so perpetual is that it is also so inescapable. You have to go to school. It's compulsory. I've left the critical thinking questions out of the beginning of the shows in this series. But I'll leave you with a question today. You can think about it between this show and the next one. Can you think of any examples of forced association or forced interaction where the people involved in that situation treat each other pleasantly? Thank you very much for listening, and take care.